Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 24th of October, 2012, and today we are joined on the line by Paul Schreier, an author, an investigative journalist, a freelance writer for numerous magazines. He's the author of Inside 9/11, a German language book about 9/11 and what was really happening on that day. It's available at inside-911.de, and the link to that will be in the show notes for today's episode. There are also various videos and information that can be gleaned from that website, so I hope you will check it out. Paul Schreier, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Excellent. Well, first, let's just start by talking a little bit about yourself and the work that you've done on 9/11. Perhaps you can tell us about Inside 9/11.
Yes, Inside 9/11 is my book, and it started about 2 years ago. A small German publisher asked me if I could write a book for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And so I started to work on that book 2 years ago. And of course, I followed all the books and all the publications about 9/11 for the last 10 years. And so this book started with this publisher asking me about it. And so after the book was published last year, I followed the topic. And because the 10th anniversary last year was a point where many people published great and interesting stories, and so I followed it till today.
Absolutely, and it is a fascinating work from what I've seen of it, and I hope people will start to explore that. But one of the things that has come out of that is a lot of interest and research into what was happening in the air defenses that day, which I think is an important and undercovered topic. But when we talk about the air defenses and what was happening on September 11th, it can be the type of subject where we get bogged down in a lot of the details, and you cover that quite well in a new paper that's just been released under the auspices of the Journal of 9/11 Studies called Anomalies of the Air Defense on 9/11. But let's just break down some of the main categories of understandings that we can glean from that paper. So, for example, in this article, you talk about the absence of command authority that was conspicuously absent on that day. Let's talk about who really was in command of what was happening that day in terms of the air defenses and where they actually were.
Yeah. You have to see what the standard procedure would be in case of a hijacking, and this is quite simple. We have the operators at the airport tower, and if one of these operators sees the air traffic controller, is the correct name. If the air traffic controller, the ATC, sees there's something wrong or there might be hijacking, he informs his superior, and the superior in turn alerts the hijack coordinator of the Federal Aviation Administration. So this is one person who would have been in charge on 9/11, and the hijack coordinator has the name of Michael Canavan, a former Special Forces general. And this Michael Canavan was not on his post on 9/11. He was in Puerto Rico that day, and also his deputy was also not in her office. Lynn Osmos, her name. And so we have an interesting connection, because this hijack coordinator would have to talk to the Pentagon in order to keep the air defense starting. And the person in the Pentagon who would have been responsible was the DDO, is the title, the Deputy Director of Operations, and that would be General Montag Winfield. His name is quite well known already, and this Winfield was also not on his post. He was in a meeting, in an Air Force rating meeting, and his deputy was in charge. And this deputy had only 1 month's experience, and that was a point that obstructed the air defense that morning.
It's really quite startling to think that all of the people who would have been in charge of that were absent from their post at that exact time. What about some of the other aspects that were interfering with the defense that day, including communications breakdown that you note in your paper?
Yeah. When I started the book, I didn't see this topic, but then I discovered that there might be more about it. because we had some communication lines that didn't work that morning. We know it, for example, quite well known from the book of former President Bush, who said he was very upset with the poor communication technology on Air Force One, as he put it. And it's quite strange. When he was aboard Air Force One, about quite before 10 o'clock in the morning, and he wanted to talk to Cheney and to Rumsfeld and to all his people, and they couldn't make a connection from Air Force One. So basically, President Bush was out of the loop for about 2 hours because communication breakdown, temporary communication breakdown, because when he landed in Barksdale Air Force Base, then everything was fine again. But this was, of course, when everything was over. So this is the first point where we had a breakdown. And then there are some more. There is, for example, what I mentioned, General Winfield in the Pentagon. There is this National Military Command Center, NMCC, it's the title. And they had to talk to the FAA, to the civilian air traffic control, to manage this crisis. And the telephone connection always kept on dropping between Pentagon and FAA. It was also a communication breakdown on this place. And this is quite strange, I think.
Absolutely. And not only is there a communication breakdown in that sense, but also in the sense of what the planes were communicating to the ATC in a certain sense. As you note, Flight 77 was hijacked precisely in the area of poor radar coverage known as a radar gap. And as you know, this was noted by the Washington Post in a report in November of 2001, but I myself have heard pretty much nothing about that particular aspect of the hijacking since then. Tell us about the significance of this.
Yeah, it's often overlooked because there exists only this one article. It's November 2001, Washington Post, and they said Flight 77 was hijacked in a radar gap, they say, in an area of poor radar coverage. So, and no one followed this article. There was no further investigation, nothing. In the 9/11 Commission report, it's mentioned, but it's not explained in any way. And when I started quite late now, last year and 2 years before, to dig into this topic, I found out nearly nothing more. It's quite strange. I approached the journalist from the Washington Post who didn't answer, and I approached a guy called Dr. Steve Bussolari, who is a scientist from the MIT's Lincoln Lab, and he made a study in 2002 by the title what was the title?
The study was Surveillance Implications of 9/11?
Yeah, you're right. The study of this Steve Bussolari was Surveillance Implications of 9/11. This was 2002. So he's quite an expert for this kind of stuff. And I approached him. And he was very polite and answered to me and said, yeah, interesting question, but he would not answer any of my questions. He said, I had to go to the FAA and ask them, and that leads to nothing. So nobody wants to talk about this. And it's really strange because this plane, the third plane, American 77, turned exactly in this radar gap. And that meant that was important for the success of the whole mission. If it hadn't turned in a radar gap where nobody could see it, it could have been intercepted without any problem by fighter jets. So this is really important, and it's quite unbelievable that nobody touched this topic since 2001.
That is really unbelievable, and I myself confess to not having really been aware of that fact. But it is quite remarkable. But how unusual is it? Do we have any idea how prevalent these radar gaps are? Are they all over the United States, or is it just in certain pockets?
This was exactly this question I asked to Steve Bussolari of MIT's Lincoln Lab, who has connections to the Pentagon, by the way. And he wouldn't answer it. And no expert wants to say anything. And I heard it's some kind of national security, of course. You could think about it. It's quite natural. But so we don't know where there are radar gaps over and how often you have radar gaps. We don't know anything about this.
Very interesting. Well, I certainly hope more researchers will be able to bring some research to that and shine some light on that. Let's talk about the simultaneous war games that were taking place on 9/11. This, of course, has been much more talked about, and there's a lot more research on this. But you raise an interesting point in your paper that I was not aware, that Richard Clark, in his book, referred to Vigilant Guardian, the exercise that that most researchers know was taking place that day, as Vigilant Warrior. And that, by NORAD code words, actually means something specific with regards to that war game. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that is a point that is also already quite old. It's from 2004, and it is Michael Ruppert who had it in his book across Rubicon. Mm-hmm. Crossing the Rubicon, right? And there he mentioned this, and he made research with NORAD, and he talked about Major Arias, who was a press person there. And he said this to him. He said NORAD code definition is Vigilant Guardian. It's common post exercise, and Vigilant Warrior in general would mean there are planes in the air. So this would be the difference between it. It's this research by Michael Ruppert from 2004, basically. And so I put this question because I don't understand why Richard Clark names it Vigilant Warrior and not Vigilant Guardian. Is it only a mistake by him, or is it a hint by him? I don't know. But we have to talk about this.
Right. So again, just to be clear, if it's a warrior exercise, that means there would actually be real live planes that would be involved in that exercise.
Yes.
Interesting. So obviously an absolutely crucial point to determine. And again, I'm not sure if anyone has ever put the question to Richard Clark. Do you know if that has ever been asked?
No, I don't know. I haven't heard about it, no.
Interesting. Well, again, another very interesting piece of the puzzle. Let's move on. You talk about absence of Andrews fighters. This is an extremely important point because, of course, Andrews Air Force Base was just 10 miles outside of Washington, D.C., and would have been best situated to obviously put fighters in the air to defend Washington airspace, but that conspicuously did not happen on 9/11. Tell us what we know about this.
Yeah, we know something about Andrews. They had planes in the air. They had planes on a training mission that morning. And about 9 o'clock, they had planes in the air and about 10 minutes flying time away from Washington. But they weren't alarmed. They weren't sent to Washington. We don't know why. We have an alert from FAA through FAA Tower in Andrews at about 9 o'clock. And but it wasn't forwarded to the military base, I think. And then we have the accounts there's very little in the 9/11 Commission report about Andrews. We have an account from Lynn Spencer's book, Touching History, from 2008. And we have, this is the main account today, I think. And in this book, they say about 9:30, we have alarm at Andrews. And, you know, 9:37 was the impact at the Pentagon, so very late. And then, according to 9/11 Commission report, they needed an whole hour to put planes in the air. The first armed plane was put in the air at 10:38, according to the 9/11 Commission report, which is quite strange. Why they needed one whole hour for this? And they say they needed it to put arm the planes, to put the missiles on board. But the first plane took off unarmed. So this makes only very little sense. And the whole Andrews episode is not really investigated. And we had public hearings from the 9/11 Commission. And the topic was, it was asked about it by Commissioner Lehmann and Commissioner Benveniste. And they both asked question to the NORAD generals. Why wasn't Andrews part of the alarm? And there were no clear answers. They declined to answer. They said we are NORAD and Andrews is no NORAD base, so we can't talk anything. We can't say anything about this. This is what NORAD generals in the public hearing said. And It has to be investigated why it took so long for Andrews, because, as you said, it's only 10 miles out of Washington.
Absolutely. And just to be clear for the listeners out there, once again, those points are addressed in your paper. And in fact, you have the actual 9/11 Commission hearing testimony from General Arnold and General McKinley in there, where they say, "I do not know that. I am unaware of the answer to that," when asked about whether they had to seek higher authority, like from the Secret Service, in order to actually get those planes launched on that mission. Extremely interesting part. And of course, we can contrast that to the response that took place with the Otis and the Langley fighters, and the adventure that they were sent on being scrambled in the wrong direction. Tell us in brief, I know there's a lot of detail here, but tell us in brief about what happened with those fighters.
Yes, we have these two bases who sent fighters while the attacks occurred. These were Otis Air Force Base at Cape Cod and Langley Air Force Base near Norfolk. And the Otis jets started at 8:52 and the Langley jets at 9:30, so in theory, they both could have intercepted the planes. The Otis jets could have intercepted the plane that crashed into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. And the Langley planes could have intercepted the plane that crashed into the Pentagon if you measure it by time. They could have done it. So we have to ask, why didn't they do it? And we have two aspects here. We have a delay in scrambling these planes. It wasn't handled as fast as it could have been. And then even more important, we have a diversion. The planes were diverted in both cases. And the Otis fighters made some kind of holding pattern over the Atlantic Ocean. And the Langley fighters were sent to the east over the ocean. It's quite well known. They were sent in the wrong direction. And what's quite interesting about this is the Langley fighters were sent at 9:30. They were scrambled to the east. The American 77 approached the Pentagon, crashed at 9:37, and the Langley fighters were turned 1 minute later, 9:38, they made a course change. This was the first time the air defense couldn't contact these fighters. Before, they had no radio connection to the fighters for unknown reasons, exactly 1 minute after the crash into the Pentagon. And this is very strange.
Very strange, to say the least. All right, once again, all of this is covered in much greater detail in your paper, Anomalies of the Air Defense on 9/11, recently published by the Journal of 9/11 Studies. I will put the link in the show notes for this interview so that people can go and read it for themselves. But let's talk about, in summation of all of these various points, what is the point to raising these points? Surely they must have been covered by the 9/11 Commission, and they must have been explained. For example, NORAD said that the war games on 9/11 actually helped improve their defense that morning. So can you put into words, why is it important for us to actually raise these questions at this time?
Yeah, and I think I can cite some lines from the 9/11 Commission report. I have it here, and you understand what they want to say. It's in very few lines. I want to read them here. It's page 45 of the 9/11 Commission report, and they say, at the end of the whole air defense chapter, they say, the details of what happened on the morning of September 11 are complex, but they play out a simple scheme. NORAD and the FAA were unprepared for the type of attack launched against the United States on 9/11. They struggled under difficult circumstances to improvise a homeland defense against an unprecedented challenge they had never before encountered and had never trained to meet. So this is the argument they make. But interestingly, the facts don't base this claim. It's only a claim. It's a story. They say they had to improvise. That's the core of their story. And if you look at what NORAD did, what the fighters did, what the air traffic controllers did, they didn't improvise. They did what they were trained for. And what's all about the points we talked about before the last minutes? You see, they did what they trained for, but they were obstructed. There was communication breakdown. That's no coincidence. You have, or you could say it in another way. I have in my paper, I have 6 points. I talk to them as anomalies. That means they are not with a conventional theory. You can't explain it. There are anomalies, but if you have 6 anomalies or maybe more, you have to put the whole theory in question, because it's not reasonable that these are coincidences. It's simply not. It's not reasonable. It's not credible that these are all coincidences. So this is the base of this. The air defense was not improvised. This is only a cover story.
That's exactly right. And again, I think you lay that out pretty well when you talk about the protocols that should have been followed but were not, the posts that should have been filled but were not, the fighters that should have been scrambled but were not.
Excuse me if I interrupt you. One more thing that's quite important and that's quite simple to understand. The thing with these fighters starting and looking for these hijacked planes is not automatically to have shot them down. It's not about shooting down. Scrambling is not shooting down. Scrambling is take off, look out what's going on, not necessarily shooting down. So this is all what it's all about. And the 9/11 Commission report, the lines I just read, these are right in the point that they weren't trained to shoot down civilian airliners. That's absolutely right. But they were trained to intercept these airliners. This is the difference you have to see.
Exactly right. And that was standard procedure. It had happened before. Fighters have been scrambled over U.S. airspace to meet challenges, for example, of planes that have stopped responding. That is standard procedure. You're exactly right on that point. Well, given that we are now 11 years on from those events, are you optimistic or pessimistic that we will be able to achieve the goal of finding answers to these questions and holding the people who were responsible for this accountable?
Yeah, that's a hard question. It depends all on the media. You know, we all know it. How many journalists cover this issue? How many people talk about this? This is what it's all about. How can we get to the media? It's an old story. We all know about it. But this is where it lies.
Yeah. It certainly does. Well, let's talk about the German context specifically. I think probably a lot of people know about some of the work that's been going on in Germany in terms of the 9/11 truth movement, but some people might be surprised to learn how much research really has been going on. So why don't you talk about some of the people who have been involved in researching 9/11 in Germany?
Yeah, in Germany we have a quite strong 9/11 truth movement, and it started with Matthias Bröckers, and his book was translated into English and is available in the US, I think. And he made three books in the last years about 9/11. And his first book was sold about 100,000 copies here in Germany. It was quite a bestseller. And he made a great job for the truth movement here in Germany. And we have a variety of authors who are very active here. We have a great website here in Germany. In German, it's 9/11 Archive. And many people are still active here and are doing a great job.
As are you, obviously, still continuing to pursue this. Of course, you have Inside 9/11, which is available from Amazon for purchase in German. Is there plans for an English translation of this book?
I tried. When the book was published last summer, I tried and talked to some American publishers, but to no success. But I think with a new study for Journal of 9/11 Studies, the paper we talk about, Anomalies of the 9/11 Air Defense, there is much of my work the research I did for my book is in this paper. So a translation is not necessary anymore. I have one greater chapter in the book about the continuity of government issue, the COG, this plan that was activated this morning. Perhaps this is something I translate in the future, I don't know. It's stuff that is based on the research of Peter Dick Scott, who made great work about this in his book, The Road to 9/11, which is, in my opinion, the best book about the whole issue.
Absolutely, a very important and again under-researched part of that day. I think not a lot of people talk about that, but it's an important issue. So I hope we will see that in the future, perhaps in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. In the meantime, people can content themselves with this paper. Once again, Anomalies of the Air Defense on 9/11. And again, that will be linked up in the show notes for this interview. Paul Schreier, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.